Meanwhile, back at the Hall of Justice, our mild-mannered podcasters were bombarded by gamma rays, bitten by radioactive bugs, mutated by toxic waste, irradiated with cosmic rays, born into a world that doesn't understand them.
Comics. Welcome to Talking Comics, episode 261. I'm your host, Mara Wood, and I'm here with Bob Ryer.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Steve Say.
I'm all by myself tonight.
And Joey Brigino.
Hello, everybody.
Big delay there on that one.
I didn't know what to say, and then I was like, do I riff off of Steve's lonely despair, or do I go off Happy Thanksgiving?
Bob usually hangs out with me, but it's getting too damn cold around here to go anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Then I have a heating pad attached to my back.
Oh.
So, I can't go too far.
It is so biting outside. Like, I just went to the food store earlier, and I was dying. Like, walking into the food store when you're super, super stiff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, see everybody doing the same thing. It's pretty funny.
Do you guys have, like, grocery pickup places up there?
You mean like order ahead kind of thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess. Or they do have delivery too, but
yeah.
I just walked to the bodega.
Okay. See, it's like a whole new world up there. I don't know what you guys got. We have Walmart pickup.
We have this thing called Peapod that you can have stuff like kind of shipped to your house. Like, they'll just arrive and knock on your door and give you all your groceries.
Nice.
And then we also have scanners that, as you're walking around shopping, you can pre-scan your food and then scan that into the machine. And it just, instead of taking everything out of your bags, you can just leave. So we've got a couple of options.
Nice.
We got Target pickup, but part of going to Target is you walk around the aisles aimlessly. So I don't want to order ahead.
Some action figures or movies or something.
That's
like.
Right.
Do you guys see the SNL skit of wasting time at Target?
No.
I think it was related to election and feelings and things like that about.
Oh yeah. Like, Target, we also have giant parking lots where you can sit in your car and think about our future.
Just wander around the store aimlessly.
SNL has been on fire the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. I've enjoyed it a lot. And usually I don't. Usually I just tolerate it. But now it's like, this is good. It's good stuff.
I think there's an Emma Stone episode coming up. She hosts when they come back from the holidays or something after Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. That should be fun.
Interesting.
She's got a big movie to promote, that La La Land with Ryan Gosling. It's going to be my favorite movie of the year. I can already tell.
I haven't even seen a trailer yet.
Oh, look it up, Bob. You'll love it. It's like a old school musical.
Nice.
Takes place in LA today. Ryan Gosling, you know, a washed up, bar pianist, and Emma Stone is a struggling actress, and they meet and dance and sing, and I'm excited. It's going to be beautiful.
It's kind of like Pal Joey, I guess.
Yeah.
Except
washed in booze.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot of comics to share tonight, and we're mixing it up a little bit.
We are
doing a beta on a new format that we're not using lightning round.
Da da da.
I know.
Who goes first?
But we have a list of comics we want to talk about on this episode, and we're just going to jump right in, and hopefully we won't go off the rails into a fiery explosion.
You're in charge, Dr. Mara.
All right.
It's on you.
I know. It's all resting on my shoulders.
It'll be fun. Don't have the timer, just have some random rude sound effects.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So let's start off with Squirrel Girl number 14.
Oh, for first of all, look at that cover. You've got Tippi with Doreen and Ant-Man, Scott Lang, tagging along behind, about to get squashed by a giant foot, because like it's of course as usual utter charming thing, and it's kind of the finale of Doreen's ruined Canadian vacation. And well, what can you do when you know the dreaded Enigmos show up and try to take over all of North America? So you get a wonderful combination, as usual, of humor and some serious stuff. And that's what makes this book work. It is ridiculously inventive and smart and also goofy at the same time. Like you get, when you stop a villain with a combination of invisible sort of out-of-body debates on the astral plane, Galileo square cube law, and action figures blown up to giant size. Come on. That's it. That's how you stop a superhero fight. Only Civil War could have ended this way.
Oh, snap. Hey, we still got two issues. One comes out today. Two more.
Really?
Yeah. Well, when the next one comes out is anybody's guess, but there is one due today. Anybody else read Squirrel Girl, by the way? Am I alone on Squirrel Girl? Aww.
I haven't read Squirrel Girl in so long.
Yeah, I'm hardcover waiting, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I have some stuff that I could probably catch up on, but I'm nowhere near Squirrel Girl 14.
So. I lent you the graphic novel, the OGN.
Yes.
That was good.
Which, yeah. I told Steve he's going to be reading that for an hour and a half. Minimum.
Mm-hmm. Took me like 3 days.
It is dense. Yeah, it is a dense book. And you have to have a magnifying glass or one of those reader things, the whole page readers they sell for old folks like me.
Hey, now I've got a pair of those too.
See, they work.
They do. They do. I have to have them to read stuff.
Aw.
So you've got another female-focused Marvel book.
Sure. It's our friend Patsy Walker, Kate Leth, Brittany Williams. And speaking of finales, it looks like that's going to come here because the Black Cat looks like she's on the wrong end of this battle, but she's not easily beaten. Once she's broken into this exhibition of the most fantastic superhero costume collection in the Western world, can Hellcat and Jubilee and her roommate Ian, under his new superhero identity of Telekinian,
Telekinian never gets old.
We've got a girl gang with matching jackets. You know, look, always a lot of fun, Pwaka, as we call her.
Yes.
And that you get to see Jubilee turn into a vampiric cloud of pink mist that looks like bubblegum that's still wearing sunglasses with fangs, worth the price of admission.
Yeah, right, man. There.
What'd you think, Joey?
I was reading through, and like they were talking about Ian. You know, part of the whole issue is Ian kind of coming into his own. And it's been, we met him in issue one, and we're seeing him evolve into this, like, you know, superpowered whatever. And like 3 pages in, they're talking about, like, okay, we're going to team up and we're going to take on Black Cat. And I'm like, he's going to get called Telekinesis.
Yes.
It's coming. And then once that panel hit where he's like, Telekinian, I'm like, yes, this is what I've been waiting for. I love this book so much. It's so wonderful. And I think that what Leth and Williams do here, it's just so good. It looks so good. Like, it has such a distinct style. And the way that Brittany Williams, like, uses the visuals for humor, it's just so smart and so expertly done. The Black Cat, her stock in the company is like elevated. She was in Silk for a while,
yes,
too.
Mm-hmm.
Like Black Cat showing up all over. I've always liked that character. She's cool. So here, it was cool to see her too.
Yeah.
And Jubilee, so awesome.
Mara, how'd you?
It's another one that's I'm trade waiting.
Aww.
But I do remember reading Black Cat in those early Silk issues when Silk did its second volume, and. It's nice to know she's still around. Yeah, yeah. It's nice to know that Black Cat is still around and still doing things and not necessarily confined to just the Spider-Man universe.
Yeah, she's a lot of places you can take the character. Can be used for humor, can certainly be used for regular superhero stuff. and here where it's a mixture of both. Without spoiling, there's a really dark moment all of a sudden here.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa!
And a really strange cliffhanger ending here at the end, too. And Black Cat has walked both sides, hero, villain. You know, she's done the horror. She's done the kind of superhero like Bob's saying. So she's a very versatile villain to have. And obviously having Black Cat versus Patsy Walker Hellcat, which is embedded puns galore. Like they have like cat lady puns. It's great. It's just a smart comic that capitalizes on everything it possibly can. But it has heart, too. You know, the character and the girl gang of Black Cat. You know, there's one girl on the gang that Ian has a history with, and the way that they explore that, it's really heartfelt and it lends weight to the book.
One of my spoiler alert, one of my books that may get discussed during Book of the Year is for a single issue is a Hellcat issue.
I know which one.
Yeah, go ahead, tell me.
I'm not gonna tell you now. It's on the air. We're on the air right now. Bob.
Okay.
Come on.
All right.
So, Joey, you've got a another book you want to talk about, Jessica Jones.
Oh, Jessica Jones. Let me tell you something about Jessica Jones. I have a theory. We're only two issues in here, but I have a theory that this comic book takes place in an alternate universe.
No.
Multiversal style. How else could you possibly explain how quickly and recklessly Brian Michael Bendis and Michael Gatos have thrown out the continuity currently running through literally every other Marvel book? There's nothing going on in any other book, Civil War II included, that would suggest the darkest timeline that is happening right now in Jessica Jones.
Right, because one of your other books is a whole Luke talk about what he's going home to do.
I know. Add to the fact, and this is reinforcing my theory, add to the fact that the curious case that Jessica is investigating right now, a case about a husband who claims to not be of this universe but is of someplace else, and I think you got, you know, a theory that stands. There's also some visual stuff. It also just might be Michael Gatos coming back to Marvel and being like, they don't still look like this, and just kind of drawing it that way. But look, we get a little bit more Luke and Jessica confrontation. We do get to see baby Daniel later in the issue. Spoilers. But this all just seems like a regression to a character from 2003. And without the context... I don't know. Without the context, it's just I'm really not enjoying this book as much as I would have hoped to. But the thing is that we can say, like, oh, maybe once we kind of know what happens in Civil War II, things will make sense. But Civil War II is almost done, and there's, like, nothing in there that would suggest this. And Jessica Jones, I don't even think has even showed up in that book once, you know? So, and even in Power Man and Iron Fist, which seems to be past Civil War II.
Yes.
I don't understand. I don't get it. I don't see how we get here. So I'm thinking that maybe this is just, you know, an alternate timeline, multiverse thing that's happening. I think that's my theory. I'm sticking to it.
Maybe there's one moment in here that really strikes me, because you're saying like there's no connection with anything else, that when something else shows up from the Marvel Universe, it's really jarring. Like Captain Marvel flying through the sky. I'm like, oh,
yeah,
she doesn't belong here. This isn't a Marvel book, is it? But Jessica's remark that perfect Carol. And so I'm like, so what happens in Civil War II? Like, what is going on here? Why? It's just really frustrating, the timing of this book relative to where the Marvel Universe is right now.
Yeah.
Well, they're starting to solicit January and February books, and Captain Marvel will become the mighty Captain Marvel, where she is apparently the most respected hero on Earth.
Yeah.
For what she did during Civil War, which, you know, to use an expression of my father's, well, cleaned up, because even though Jessica and Luke curse like sailors, over in Power Man Iron Fist, it's all about fiddle faddle, so I'm not going to curse. But Carol, you know, fell in crap and came up covered in diamonds.
Yeah.
Somehow. That people are dead and stuff is destroyed, but she's a big hero here. I don't know. This book, Luke and Jessica are in their own civil war, for goodness sakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like, yeah. Can't we get over this already? It's like, no, stop. And there's a baby involved. Yeah, no.
And seeing Luke curse was so jarring. I was like, nope, I'm out. Nope. This is not what I want. So I don't know. I'll stick around for maybe a couple more through the end of Civil War II. Maybe something will happen that'll make this make sense, but I don't foresee that happening. And that's such a bummer because I love Alias. And I even love The Pulse, which not a popular thing to say. The Pulse that followed Alias was actually I enjoyed that too.
Yeah, it's all right.
And I loved watching Luke and Jessica as characters evolve through New Avengers. Under like this is the other thing. Under Bendis' pen, you know? Yeah. Like this is like he like where is he? What is he? And he's also writing Civil War II. So like something happens, I suppose, but it's just like, you know, darkest timeline. It's very jarring and not something that I'm enjoying at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Let me throw something at you, Joey. What if this was only a Jessica series? Jessica on this case of the alternate universe, or maybe she is or isn't in it herself. I think I would like it a lot more. I would give it a lot more leeway.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking definitely. Luke and the kids into it.
Which, when they released that, like, you know, 8-page backup back when the Netflix series was coming out, that's what it seemed to suggest, right? It seemed to be like Jessica Jones being like, I'm back in business, baby. And that was like, we got excited. And then we pick up this book and it's about, you know, exploding her relationship with Luke Cage, you know, and all of that. But you just said something, Bob, that she doesn't know she's in the alternate universe, and she's gonna find out she's in the alternate universe.
Uh-oh.
Oh, my God. This is wild. See? My theory stands.
Yes, I don't doubt it. Though, what's her name? Brownlee. Is it her husband who was asking, what happened to the Fantastic Four, and where's everybody else, and why are these heroes fighting with each other?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so is it Brian Michael Bendis' commentary on his own work?
Yep. And he's blowing up his own series and doing stuff.
Having just watched JFK, because of what today is, well, yesterday for some of you people, the anniversary of that event, where in the movie someone says of the Jim Garrison character, he tells himself something on one side of his brain is the truth and convinces the other side somehow that it is.
Yeah, a little cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, so maybe that's happening, you know, with Mr. Bendis. He's running so many books at once, the two sides of his brain are at a civil war.
Interesting. Joey,
help us, Mara.
Well, let's move into another Marvel book, Black Panther number 8. Was this one touched by Civil War II, or is it kind of separate from everything else?
No, Black Panther is running its own long form story right now under Ta-Nehisi Coates. It's in fact, Black Panther 8 is almost a kind of standalone issue in a series that, like I said, is this kind of long form story rather than a serialized comic thing. This is going to read great all collected. I'm telling you that right now. It starts with the aftermath of the crew's clean sweep of the bad guys and moves quickly to the Shuri storyline that's been percolating in the background since the first issue. And that story, her story kind of gets resolved here in issue number 8 in gorgeous fashion. Shuri, if you remember, has been in kind of a life between death on the Jalia, a transcendent plane of Wakanda's past, present, and future, and has been learning from a pseudo-ghost sage-like griot kind of character. As Shuri kind of learns what it means to lead and be a part of people and to have strength in this plane of transcendent existence, T'Challa and Manifold are bending time and space to kind of bring her back to the land of the living, as it were. It's trippy, but Coates's strength in this series, I think, now that we're 8 issues in, we can kind of see it, is he's doing this really interesting thing where he's telling a political story, a story about politics and nation states and all of that, but he's doing so while also blending in science and technology, but also spirituality and tradition. And the way that he juggles those kind of three arenas has built to something really complex, really nuanced, and really intriguing from the beginning. It is a tough book to follow month to month.
Yeah.
But I think as an overall book, Black Panther is probably one of the most elevated and daring books, I think, and pioneering books in the Marvel stable right now under Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Interesting. Yeah, I stopped after the first arc because I felt that trade waiting would be the best way to read this story.
It probably is.
Yeah.
I did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. It's just hard to keep up with it.
Yeah. It's month to month, you're wanting to go back and read because you're getting so many little shots of Wakandan history. It's like, okay, how did this relate to what we had before? Because that comes before, but we're told it after. And brilliantly done. The art this time was Chris Sprouse.
Mm-hmm.
And it was absolutely gorgeous, particularly the otherworldly stuff.
Yeah.
And that killer ending.
Killer ending. Oh, I was like, yeah, girl, get it. It was so good. And then to read that book, and then Black Panther was in the news again because Angela Bassett just got cast in the movie.
Yeah.
Which is, I was just like, oh my God, this movie's going to be great. And they got a great book on the stands that people will pick up and trade for. You know, mm-hmm. I think that's the thing too. Like, we're reading it month to month because we're reading comics. But I think once that movie drops and once it becomes more in the news, people are going to go pick up the trades.
Yeah.
And the story that Coates is telling in a collection. Be really something that you know, there's patterns and motifs and things that you have to go back and check and look at, and I think he's writing a long form story because I think that's how he thinks about stories, mm-hmm. coming from where he comes from, you know. Between the World and Me, his book from a couple of summers ago, I read this past summer, it's organized as almost a series of little chunks, but you can't read it like that. You have to read it as an overall piece. And I think that Black Panther is going to read it the same way.
Interesting. Well, one book that's less cognitively engaging, but still interesting, this month is Spider-Man number 9 by Bendis again. And Nico Leon.
Bendis.
Yes. Yes. And this one is heavily tied to Civil War too.
Oh boy.
So, last we checked in with the actual main Civil War II storyline, there was a vision of Miles Morales standing over Steve Rogers, Captain America's body that's been impaled on, like, whatever. And it was implied in that moment that Miles is responsible for Steve Rogers' death in whatever future that is being predicted. So with that information, of course, he runs away. And nobody can find him. Ms. Marvel and Nova goes to his home, and Miles' dad finds him there, and they're like trying to get on his computer and trying to explain what's going on, and Miles' dad's trying to get involved. Goldballs is looking for him. Genki is looking for him. And it's just kind of an interesting comic as far as people trying to piece things together. It does feel like it's treading water, though, because it's essentially a search for Spider-Man and all these side characters getting some more panel time, especially Genki and the YouTuber Danica, I believe is her name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Steve, did you read this one?
I did. You're a lot nicer about it than I would be.
Oh, snap.
I mean, when you really break it all down and you go through it page by page, you can find the events and where things happen, kind of the bullet points of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
But in reading it a couple hours ago, I just felt like it didn't go anywhere. It didn't do anything.
It was
like
just treading water.
Like, it starts off with people questioning where Miles is and wondering where he's disappeared to. And it ends with the same sentiment. Like, they're still confused. Like, I felt like the whole issue, we were just talking about him being gone. And I don't know. This whole arc has been really weird and really taking me out of the character, and I haven't liked it very much. And it's a shame because I've been reading Miles pretty much since, you know, issue one of that first stuff, and I love the character. And it's still the same writer, same creator, and, you know, he obviously has ideas in mind for where he wants him to go, but this arc has just been so slow.
Mm-hmm. It's so bogged down by the event. And since the writer is also doing the event,
mm-hmm.
it's just easier to kind of piece those things together in that way.
Like, my whole thing, one of the reasons why I kept reading it was because Sarah Pacelli was on art, and she's one of my favorites, and I'm like, I'm buying this because it's gorgeous, and because it's, you know, it's still her. And then the new artist came on for this issue, Nico Leone, with colors by Marta Garcia, and I just, it was great. Like, the art is still the high point of this book for me right now. This arc, I'm saying, like, while the subject matter of it hasn't been all too interesting for me, it has been gorgeous. And I almost didn't even notice that it was another artist until I went back and looked.
I can see
so,
that.
Like, I like the stuff with Genki. I like that he kind of has a moment later on in the book where he shares a moment with somebody, and it's really kind of sweet and nice, and it's quiet. You know, but if you know that character, you know exactly what's going on in his head, and it's really sweet. And I was like, okay, that was a really nice moment. But again, it's one of those books that I think that if you, like, once Civil War is over, and once we have the finale and the conclusion, and we find out exactly how Miles was involved in everything, I think reading them from start to finish in a row will be an exciting thing. I just don't know that it's catching me every month. It feels slow coming out monthly.
Agreed. Yeah. I mean, I like the character moments, but, you know, I think for me, it's Civil War II has been an interesting storyline that I'm ready to see the fallout. And we've gotten glimpses of the fallout from Infamous Iron Man and Jessica Jones and all these champions, things like that, but we don't know why. So it's been a little bit backwards, a little bit weird, and, you know, it's kind of like, well, okay, so this is actually taking place before Champions, so obviously Miles is going to be okay because he joins Champions later. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's, huh. Yeah.
That sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, oh, wait, that this is what happens terrible. When the delays on the main book are, you know, happen, and the books are pushed back, and we don't have all the pieces, and reading things out of order, you kind of just need to be like, oh, you know, comics, and be okay with the unknowing, at least for a few months, you know, but it puts the reader at an imposition. And I feel very lost in some of the stories that I'm reading right now from Marvel.
It's certainly going to make the ending of Civil War anticlimactic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there have been a lot of killer books, too. Like, absolutely. It's not across the board. There's been Power Man and Iron Fist has been just fantastic, you know, from the get-go. It handled the Civil War stuff so interestingly, and it really had something to say, and I love that. Like, I loved that about that series. Some of the Patsy Walker stuff has been really good. The Spider-Woman stuff has been fantastic. Ms. Marvel has been incredible, you know?
Do you think that, because, I mean, and we don't have the numbers, obviously, but do you think that, I feel like with this event and this fallout, the things that you guys are talking about, I feel like more so than previous events, why would I pick up Champions? Or why would I pick up some of these, you know, newer books or continue reading those newer books without knowing what happens in Civil War II? Or if I dropped off from Civil War II in the middle, as I'm sure most people do, do you think Marvel is learning any lesson from this, especially with the books at the price point that they are? You know, will Champions sell as well as it would have to in the singles? Are they just kind of waiting, like, oh, people will pick up the trades anyway in five issues when Civil War II is done? Like, what is the lesson that comes out of this?
Well, I'd like to think that they'll look at falling sales numbers and the fact that they were beaten a couple of months here by DC, even though DC had 50% less books out. And they'll look at, well, there was more energy for their event than Civil War.
That wasn't even an event.
Yes, but it played as one as people were energized to try not only the books they thought they would, but other things, because I like the energy.
Yeah.
Will it affect the sales of some of these new books that are just now coming out? What, since there's no event end, what are the sales of something like Mosaic like, or the Deadpool spinoffs?
Yeah.
It's going to be interesting to see what's the drop off. You know, we talk of in movies week one to week two, being 60% being a bad week or whatever. In comics, it's somewhat similar.
Yeah.
Stores order based on an old formula, and what I've heard anecdotally is some of these second issue numbers are more like 75% drops from the first issue.
Because, I mean, just going off of Mars' comment, like, you're reading Spider-Man number 9, and you're reading Champions, and Miles is fine in Champions, right? So does that mean that, oh, I'll keep reading Champions, or does that mean I will stop reading Spider-Man and Civil War 2 because that thread is done, or whatever, you know?
With the Secret Wars, where you – each, not every book, but mostly every book had the last days things slapped onto a couple of issues. And some worked very well.
Oh, yeah.
Others were just useless. And it's, well, why should I read the last three issues of anything in a universe that's going to come to an end? I'll just stop.
Yeah.
I'll pick it up at number one in March.
Yeah.
Good point.
Weird decision making.
So let's move on to our last Marvel book for this episode, Doctor Strange, number 14.
If people remember, not that they're paid to or anything like that, I was a little sour at the end of the first arc that I thought it didn't come to a good enough conclusion. I wanted some uplift. And that's happened over the last couple of issues. This one, you know, magic has sort of been destroyed. A lot of the elements in the magical part of the Marvel Universe have gone a little awry. And so Doctor Strange is trying to put something together, and he keeps running afoul of his old enemies. And in this case, it's Satana, the devil's daughter, who in her version of the underworld has a diner called Hell's Kitchen. And she's starting her own magical theme park and wants Steven to be the star attraction. And she intends to do that by feeding him demonic bacon so he'll die. Now, that this is all served up by a short order cook who is Master Pandemonium, if people remember the old Defenders books, where he has a demon for each hand. And so they're fighting in the kitchen with each other and him, and there's living food all over the place. The weirdest set of diner patrons you can imagine. It's the worst sort of greasy spoon ever. The art is absolutely stunning.
It's fantastic. I mean,
yeah. Might be Botchel's best issue of this series, which is saying a heck of a lot. Clever story. You get to see Doctor Strange act like his own Alka-Seltzer. Now, come on. Come on. This is good stuff.
Yeah.
So you loved it, Mara?
I thought it was a lot of fun. Doctor Strange has not been capturing my attention so much. At least this volume. I think it was like the last days of magic really just kind of for me.
Mm-hmm.
But this issue was so much fun, and the little astral projection he made of himself, that where does his clothes?
Well, they put a nice little bar across the naughty.
They did. So I wish they had done what they did for Hawkeye.
Oh yes.
With the face. So yeah. It was just Doctor Strange's face covering the important bits. That would have been hilarious.
But we have black bars and captions covering them and all sorts of things.
Well, it just cracked me up the whole time because looking at it, it's just so dense and so detailed. But to see this little white tiny figure with a big black bar across the midsection of his body, I'm like, oh yeah, this is humorous. This is hilarious. So I thought it was a nice touch.
Yeah, it's fun, but there's one panel where he's actually carrying the black bar in such a way that it covers up, you know, any protrusions. It's just
protrusions.
Yes.
Nice.
Did anyone else read this issue?
I did not, no.
Okay.
No.
All right, so Doctor Strange redeemed everything else that was happening this week over in Marvel. Okay, for some reason, we only had one DC book this week that we wanted to pick up. I don't know how that happened, especially since Nightwing came out, y'all, and Trinity and Cave Carson, Batman, a bunch of other stuff.
That's all good. Yeah. You know, it's just all the stuff we want to talk about.
Yeah, yeah. But the one DC book I definitely want to bring up is Superman number 11.
Yeah.
Yes. So in this arc, In the Name of the Father, World's Smallest, Part 2, Damian and John have to team up together to earn their costumes back, earn their gear back from their dads. The idea being that both of these boys are so hard-headed and stubborn that they need to learn how to work together like their fathers have learned to work together and put aside their differences to be a super team. And of course, you know, Damian looked down at John. John doesn't know what he's doing. Yeah. He's still trying to figure out his powers. And the thing that brings them together is, you know, the endangerment of their family. And I thought it was a really cute issue. I know there are people out there who, for them, superhero comics are, you know, high stakes adventures, killing aliens, saving the world and things like that. But I love these smaller moments of the superhero family and the bonding and the friendship. And we do this because we want to be good people, those kinds of moments. So this issue in particular was fantastic. It was a great follow-up to the first issue where Damian kidnapped John and tried to, you know, figure out what was wrong with him.
See, I didn't read that one. Yikes.
Well, you know Damian, he just does what he wants.
Well, they took his cape away.
Yeah, they took his cape away. He had to go earn it back. Did anyone else read this issue?
I did, yeah.
What
did
you think? Too.
Oh, go ahead, Bob.
No, go, Steve.
Yeah, I echo a lot of what Mara was saying. It's delightful. The art on this book in particular, there was a lot of people on this, on pencils. We had Mick Gray, Mark Morales, and Christian Alami. And, ooh, God, it looks so good. It's so intricate and it moves. There's just movement on every page, and it really brings kind of the adventuring and the harrowing bits of this this kind of test or mission that mm-hmm. they're on together. And it really just it elevates the story, and even the bickering looks amazing. Or when they're flying around, like there's just such like the wind's picking up and there it just leaps right off the page. I love the little parts between Superman and Batman as they're kind of looking in on their boys' progress and discussing, like they're all acting all regal and they're like, you know, not even addressing the fact that they used to beat the living crap out of each other, you know, every opportunity that they had. And it's totally a case of like the pots calling the kettles black type of things. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea of putting kind of the Boy Scout with the bad boy.
Yeah.
And the bad boy brings out the bad boy in the Boy Scout. if that makes any sense. And it's just, it's funny. It feels like an all ages book to me at times, at least this arc does.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're just, the creative team is, they work really, really well together. There are a few teams that I think have this, like, this bond and the synchronicity that, Peter J. Tomasi and Patrick Gleason have with one another. And it just shows on every project that they work on together.
Mm, yeah. Bob, would you
think? I have a question.
Okay.
First of sure. all, which Superman is this one?
This is pre-New 52 Superman.
Okay. Yeah. So
the other one's dead.
Maybe.
Yeah. And his Lois is too, right? That's how this works.
Yes.
So Jonathan is from the other universe.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So who are Maya and Goliath?
I think they're from that We Are Robin thing.
Okay.
I think
Goliath is from the Son of Batman
okay.
series
okay.
that Damian was in for a little while.
Because he was a lot of fun in this book.
Yeah, yeah. He's kind of, he reminds me a little bit of Falcor from The Neverending Story.
There you go. I really enjoyed this. Again, I haven't been picking it up, but you could pick up the threads pretty mm-hmm. quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And I definitely want to go back and read issue number 10. I love when they finally get through, you know, London Bridge has fallen down or wherever they, you know, mm-hmm. the crazy train wreck yeah. they get away from. And they're sort of, oh, I guess they want us to work together and be teammates or and David is, or worse, friends. Do you think? Never. Yeah, right. Never. It's just, It's just, it's really like two little boys.
Mm-hmm.
And that just made her a heck of a lot of fun. That moment with Alfred where he's, you know, everyone's big brother, granddad, mm-hmm. Dutch uncle, whatever you want to say. Just really, just a really lovely book.
Yeah.
Had a great, glad you picked it. It was fun to read.
Yeah, I loved it. I love Superman. I like Action Comics. Thank you, DC. Thank you. So let's move on to some of our more independent books. We're going to start with Backstagers, number 4.
Oh my God. I love this book so much. It is like one of my favorites, definitely. So it's the final tech rehearsal and tensions are high.
Mm-hmm.
Complicating things even more is the disappearance of Sasha, who, if you remember from issue 3, feeling guilty for breaking the special light crystal thing, ventured into the backstage all alone and is now missing. And the whole crew is super worried about him. I've talked about how true this book is to the kind of spirit of theater. And this week, two things happened that I was like, okay, it's decided. James Tynion or Ryan Tsai, one of them, definitely theater nerd growing up. Because first, Jory goes to get snacks for everybody just to make him feel better. Mm-hmm. And the one character's like, I don't want anything. And he's like, well, what about Twizzlers and Diet Coke? And the guy just snatches them. And I'm like, yes, that is 100% accurate. Without Twizzlers and Diet Coke. I've eaten so many Twizzlers. And the second thing that happens is they go on this rescue mission to get Sasha in the backstage, and they come across a rickety old catwalk, and all catwalks in all theaters are rickety and dangerous. Mm-hmm. I don't care how advanced and new the theater is. But things start going very badly. Things are breaking, and what do we do when things start breaking in the theater? We bust out the duct tape.
Exactly.
And that's what they do in this book, and they're just like, duct tape powers activate. And it's just like, this is like real-life theater fantasy style. Duct tape, Twizzlers, Diet Coke. It's every theater nerd survival kit, you know, top to bottom. So this book is awesome, and it, like, subverts all kinds of tropes as it tells a story that is once, you know, magical and fantastical, but it's also authentic and really, like, a lot of fun mm-hmm. cover to cover. And as we enter the back half of the series, like, I sincerely hope that, you know, A, Boom pulls one of their, we like this book so much, it's an ongoing now. Like, I hope that happens. But I think that I just know that the story is going to get whimsical and crazier as it goes on. I just really love this book, and it's highly, highly recommended from my perspective.
Mm-hmm. I like that there's a lot of raw emotions.
Yeah.
In it, like, every other page, there's someone just tearing up because of friendship.
Yeah, this is a beautiful moment where, like, Aziz, one of the tech guys, you know, he's like, I told his mom that I would keep him safe at stage crew, and you know, like, and he starts crying, and I just, it's so good, and it's so true, and wonderful.
Yeah.
Aw.
Hey, Bandette, Volume 3.
Well, we are at Volume 3 of the Dark Horse hardcover collections of the Monkey Brain digital book. It's The House of the Green Mask, Paul Tobin, Colleen Coover. And not to bury the lead, this is one of the most charming things I have ever read, ever. Just ever. I was introduced to this series by Stephanie way, way back, and I can't say I've never peeked at a digital issue. There are a couple of issues sitting in my Comixology account or looked online. But this time, I decided to just trade weight entirely. And I have to say that the delay was hard to do, but it really heightened my enjoyment of reading it in a great lump. I have the usual wonderful little mystery. It's about an old-time magician and a house filled with treasures and mysteries that are various and sundry assortment of bad folks are looking for that we've seen in the series before. And one of them is the infamous Dart Petite, who shoots little darts at people. And she's got Bandette trapped with her boyfriend Daniel on this high wire between two buildings. And she says to, I know you were quite nimble, but you were a fool to go out onto the wire. A fool, Bandette? No, Bandette is many things, but she is not a fool. The epitome of all thieves? But of course Bandette is that. A friend to her urchins. Again, correct. Is Bandette an alluring mystery that will never be solved? And she is also a champion chocolate eater and a great lover of the arts and without doubt the most charming of all femmes. But a fool? No, no, no.
That's book is so French.
What you get. But you know what it's like, Steve? You buy lots of, in your time, I'm sure you bought lots of imported CDs and whatever.
Oh, but yes.
It's when you read the lyrics to an English song that have been translated into Japanese or another language and then back again. Mm-hmm. So this is the English translation of an English book that had been translated into French in between.
Gotcha.
In that it's very French, very, but it's often just the quirkiest, most wonderful way. It is, look, buy it digitally, however you want to look at it, it's great. But these $14.95 hardcovers, wonderfully bound, great covers, text stories in the back, sketches, making ofs, just a brilliant package every time around, and just a wonderful piece of work by Tobin and Coover. Can't Indeed. Be happier to buy Bandette, and just great. Steve, did you read Volume 3 yet?
I haven't read it. It's on my table. I did buy it. I have the three hardcovers. They look so nice. And I'm curious, though, has Bandette won anything in the past for our awards? I feel like it has.
Yes, it's been on for... It's been nominated for Best Overall Series.
Okay.
And I know it's won Best Digital at least once.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. We have a new number one from Boom this week about roller derby.
Hell yes, we do. Slam number one. Yo, roller derby, what? This book was crazy.
Wait, first off, have you guys been to a roller derby before?
I actually dated somebody who was in roller derby a couple years ago.
Okay.
Badass. Right there.
If I say I did, but it was in the 70s with my mom, does that count?
Yes.
Charlie O'Connell and Joni Weston and the San Francisco Bay Bombers, those guys.
Ooh. My ex, her name was Andromeda, and her actual name was Andromeda, but she was Haiti Bruiser on the Brooklyn Bombshells.
Nice.
Yeah, she was mean.
Okay, Joey, continue.
Yeah, Boom Studios, we got Pamela Ribbon and Veronica Fish. It might be Ribbon, because there's one B. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Ribbon? I don't know.
Ribbon.
Ribbon. Pamela Ribbon. Pamela Ribbon, Veronica Fish, colors by Brittany Peer. Boom, new number one. Roller Derby. We got two characters here, Jen Chu and Maisie Huff. They're rookies at the Derby, but both through some tough times in their lives. Mm-hmm. They find each other. They find something they love to do. They find a community of badasses kicking ass nightly. And at the end of the issue, though, there might be some complications down the line because drama, yo. You can't have a book without drama. this book is freaking cool as hell. Veronica Fish absolutely kills every single panel of every single page. I love the story, and Pamela Ribbon does a great job. But I think visually, this is one of the coolest books. It's kinetic, it's dynamic, and... it's just a great first issue, and it starts with the cover. Like, the cover is so fierce. It's just like Jen, and she's just like wiping neon pink blood from like this green. It's just so, it's so good. And there's this line where they're like, "Oh, I'm so nervous. It's before the first big derby," and it's like, "Oh, I'm so nervous. Yeah, I pooped six times," and I was like, "I'm in." That's it. I'm in. That joke just nailed me. I was like, that's it. I'm in. Whatever happens from here on in, I'm totally, totally down for it. I just.
You have that concept. Connection right off the bat.
Yeah. Right off, nervous, poop six times. That's what's up. But, you know, the characters are great. There's something about, like, there's the last year, a couple of years, I've seen a lot of, I don't know why, like, boxing movies, like Southpaw and. And Creed, you know, it's just like dudes beating each other up and, you know, finding themselves. And I was so glad to like read this one and be like, oh yeah, women beating each other up and finding themselves. Like I was just like, cool, this is great. So I had a great time with Slam number one.
Mm. Did anyone else read this book?
I wanted to, and then I found out that my access to the Dropbox has been deleted. So I need to fix that.
Okay.
But it looks amazing. I saw some of the preview pages. And I can't wait to read it. I'm really excited that Joey liked it as much as he did.
Yeah, it'll get me to take it. shot at it too.
Yeah,
Old roller derby. Did you read it, Mara?
I did, and you know, second to everything Joey says, I read it twice. There are very few books I go back and read twice in the same week. Superman number 11 was one of them this week, as well as Slam, and it was just so much fun. I loved seeing the pre-derby, post-derby takes on the girls, like how derby changed their life, and the idea that if your life is falling apart, being in this kind of competitive sport will make it better. But if your life is going fine, that being in roller derby will just turn everything upside down. So it was kind of a fun book, very colorful. The girls are fun and relatable. I'm excited for number two.
It makes me want to watch Whip It.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
Yeah.
Okay, so less happy, more sad. Black Hammer number 5.
Did you read it, Mara?
Downright depressing.
Really?
I thought it was. Well, okay, so go ahead. You start, and I'll tell you why I thought it was depressing.
Okay. We got to spend a lot of time with Colonel Weird this issue. It was the Odyssey of Randall Weird, and it's kind of his trips into the Parazone. And skipping ahead a little bit in the story, basically, he gets asked a question about his goings on and how he gets into the Parazone and how he's able to phase in and out of the bubble. Why does he choose to come back and stay with the family? And why can't he take them into the Parazone and use that kind of doorway, that window, to escape their incarceration in this farm town? That certain characters are really tired of it.
Yeah.
And they want to live again, and they want to live outside. And you know, the only person that can get out is Colonel Weird. But what you find out is we spend a lot of time in the Parazone, and we kind of get the origin story of how Colonel Weird became trapped in there. And it's very Ditko-esque as far as the visuals. It is really impressive, very cool, very creepy. And there's definitely some weird hallucinogenic stuff. And it's really cool in a way that the artwork is lending so much to the character and so much to the story, because it's showing you visually where he is and where he spends most of his time. And it is a truly maddening place. And it gives you a really cool insight to a character that we haven't spent a whole lot of time with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it really kind of serve to elevate like the interest level in him. Like up until now, he's just been kind of in and out. He'll make a funny joke or some obscure reference, and then he'll disappear. This time we actually get to see kind of the tragedy of his deal.
Mm, yeah.
And go ahead, Mara.
Yeah. Okay. So what I mean by depressing and sad is, okay, so Colonel Weird is just like the kooky grandpa character. You don't know what's going on. He does his own thing. He's very unpredictable. And you know, that Parazone to me is kind of the source of his insanity, of his madness. And we have those flashback stories of who he was back in the 50s and 60s and the woman he was in love with and how that relationship didn't work out so great because of his involvement with the Parazone. Mm-hmm. And so to me, I was like, oh, so tragic, because the way it's portrayed, he can never really truly escape her. And you can never really truly be with her. And I was like, oh, that's, you know, if I were Colonel Weird, I would just spend all my time in the Parazone and never show up on the farm, or, you know, have a, what's her name, Gail?
Yeah.
Or have Gail yell at me about, you know, I'm 9. Like, still, fix it. So I thought it was a really good issue.
Mm-hmm.
It left me kind of like, oh, feel really bad for him.
That splash page of the woman, mm-hmm. and what happens to her in the Parazone,
yeah.
is probably one of my favorite pages of the year.
It's so crazy.
It is. Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. It reminds me a little bit of the artist Alex Gray. He's done a lot of artwork for Tool and their later albums and stuff like that. And it's also, I love his character because so much of his deal is like metaphysical.
Mm-hmm.
And he's able to change his identity in for brief amounts of time and everything. And then you start to question, you know, why don't you just stay that way
instead
of returning back to this ghost of a man who is constantly indulging in insanity. Mm-hmm. And it's just like you saw him an issue ago, like kept and composed and speaking clearly and like actually rather impressive. And then he reverts back to this kind of this like specter or creature, and he's the only one able to escape, but he chooses not to. It's he's very fascinating. Yeah. I think.
Yeah. Anyone else on Black Hammer?
That had begun sort of the first couple of issue covers were very sort of old fashioned mm-hmm. pulpy superhero-y kind of thing. Right, yeah. Steve? Those are the ones.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Mm-hmm. And it's still that too. Like it is yeah. totally still that pulpy feel to it. There's definitely, they kind of rein it in every couple of pages and remind you of where you are, because you spend a lot of time in the Parazone, mm-hmm. but every now and again they're like, you know, this is, you know, we still have this stuff going on, and they move the plot along. Like for one or two other characters, there's some interesting stuff, but it's very much exploring the reason why him bringing them out of the bubble is not an option.
Right.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Okay, so another Dark Horse book that came out this week was Lady Killer 2, number 3.
Number 3, by Joelle Jones and Michelle Madsen on covers. You get to see here the connection between Josie's mother-in-law, Mother Schuler, and Josie's new business partner, Irving Reinhardt, and boy, is it a doozy. This was teased near the end of the first arc when they went to the Seattle World's Fair, mm-hmm. and she saw him wandering the aisles, and there was this moment, and now we see why. And just again, considering the period, I'm not going to give that away, but as usual, just clever and to the point. It is a very dark book. There's a 2-page spread here that is absolutely gorgeous of Josie and Irving at work. Happily at work, she's holding a compact to her face and dabbing the blood off while he flays and eviscerates the victims of her job. Think the Harvey Keitel character from Point of No Return in Pulp Fiction. And that's what he does, which he might have done before. I'll just leave it at that. He had a job doing this otherwise.
Yeah.
There's some twists and turns to that as Josie tries to balance her family life. And it's the mid-60s, the rise of the women's movement. As when we spoke to Ms. Jones on the show, it wants to tie into that. And Josie wants to have it all in that Helen Gurley Brown way. And it's difficult when you're a contract killer is all I'm going to say.
It is.
Yep.
Very much so.
So hard.
Yeah.
Just can't have it all.
No. But she's trying. Josie's in there pitching. What, did anybody else read Lady Killer?
Oh, mm-hmm. Hell yes.
Okay. Shoot, Joey.
It
no
is
pun intended.
So... Sorry. It is so pretty, this book.
All the blood. Like,
it is just the blood and the line work and the dismemberment, like, and the colors. Like, it is just such a beautiful book. Like, I just like opened it up and I was like, this is probably one of the best things to look at in this entire, in all the books I read last week, you know? So what Joelle Jones is doing there for Lady Killer 2 is just leaps and bounds above even what they did for Lady Killer 1, mm-hmm. but also just leaps and bounds in terms of the comic book visuals than, you know, a lot of other things that are out there right now. So I love this book, and thanks, Bob, for pointing me to it, because it's just great.
Mm-hmm. You're very welcome.
I liked it. I liked it a lot. I can't think of anything. It's just like those pages of Mother Schuler and Irving kind of just going at it.
Yes.
It's just great.
We always knew she had a backbone, but who knew, right?
Yeah. She's hiding something. Like, ever since we saw her, you're like, she's not all she's up to. You know, she's got something else going on. So I'm glad we dove into that a little bit with this issue. Next up is Spell on Wheels, number 2.
Yes, yes. So Spell on Wheels is one of those books for me. You know when you want to just take a break from everything
yeah.
and just have a laugh and just chill out. This is one of those books. The ladies are on the hunt for their apartment got broken into and their witchcraft stuff that they were going to use to basically perform a certain ceremony have been stolen, and now they're tracking down the items. And one of the items has been sold to a creepy old man. And they drive to his house, and you basically find out that he runs like a commune for hipsters. And he throws these kind of weekend parties where he spikes people's drinks and tries to siphon their creativity and life energy in order to make a comeback. He used to be a painter. He used to be a pretty popular painter, but he hasn't had like a good painting in like 20 years or so. And it's just this, it's one of those books where it's a ridiculous situation. It's filled with ridiculous people and ridiculous characters. The commentary on kind of the hipster lifestyle and the attitudes of it with Kate Leth writing is pretty damn funny and pretty on point. But you take the attitudes of the three girls, and I kind of liken this book to Giant Days in the strong personalities category.
Yes, yes.
Of that, you know so much of who these women are just by the way that they speak and their actions and their roles in, you know, their collective friendship and stuff like that. And so they end up having, you know, some of them end up having a few drinks, and it leads to, you know, magic and capering and all these weird things and all this, you know, all this funny stuff. And you don't know who you can trust. And it's cool. It's like it's a little Scooby-Doo. It's a little bit of The Craft. It's just one of those cool books that's like going on elsewhere in the indie part of the comic book universe that is a lot of fun. There's three of them left, you know, a nice little five-part series. And it's just personality, personality, personality. Mm-hmm. You know, Kate Leth has a lot of attitude in general, and it comes out. She does, but to her credit, she uses it. She channels it, and she puts it into her writing when she's doing some of these newer books that I've been reading of hers, between Patsy Walker and Spell on Wheels, and some other things that she's worked on. And I like the sass. You know.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Yeah, so I really enjoyed it. It was one of those things where like, should I just wait for the trade? Nah, I'm going to pick this up. I really liked the first one, and the second one was just as much fun. And like, I now know that I'm on board to pick this up individually until it's over.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you said it's five part series?
Yep.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, I enjoyed issue number two as well. Like you said, like it's that dynamic between these girls where you have one that's a little bit more naive and gullible. Mm-hmm. One who's kind of, you know, just out there and very personable, and one who's kind of wary of everything.
Right.
And I liked, you know, like you said, is that those personalities fitting together, and how, you know, friendships aren't just people of the same exact mentality coming together and echoing each other. It's challenging and growing, and you're not my mom kind of stuff going on. And I liked it. I liked the characters.
I died when I turned to the page where you see the guy with the big man bun and the acoustic guitar, and he's singing Wonderwall.
Yes. Yep.
Like, and they're all like, "He's amazing." The one character who's sober is like, "Oh my god!"
I was like, "I've been to this party, and I was her.
Get me out of here." So very charming, very cool. And, you know, it moves. Like these little stories of them picking up these objects and stuff so far have been really neat. You know, yeah. Good beginning, nice first adventure, and we have three more to look forward to. So it's cool. I'm digging it so far.
Yeah. All right. We've got one I don't know anything about. Joey, you're going to have to explain this from like the very beginning.
Go for it, Joey.
Yakuza Demon Killers.
Yeah.
Yakuza Demon Killers number one.
It's all ages. It's all ages, right?
Yeah, not all ages. Not all ages. Amit Chauhan, Eli Powell, and K. Michael Russell here for IDW. It's basically Yakuza Demon Killers, like exactly what the title would call for. It's what you get, okay? Some people try to jack a mystical sword in Tokyo. demons come. The Yakuza come that specialize in whacking demons. Hilarity ensues. That's the book. Like,
sold.
Exactly.
How did you come to get this?
Well, I put together the pull lists for every week, and I always make sure to list whatever the publishers are putting out as a number one.
Okay.
So Yakuza Demon Killers number one was this past week, so it was on the list. So I put it on there, and I made sure of all the books of last week that I loved reading. I was like, I'm going to read Yakuza Demon Killers and see what's up. So two things here. Number one, for a book that's called Yakuza Demon Killers, it looks exactly like you would want that kind of book to look like, that kind of horror suspense. It's very kind of Vanessa Del Rey, Tyler Crook, Michael Lark, Mac Chater, kind of gritty, dark, also kind of trippy artwork in there. So visually, it's really cool. Mm-hmm. And then the hook, the first sequence is just grabs you. You got this girl, our protagonist, she's like in an alley in Tokyo, doped up, you know, just a belt on her arm, strung out. And she's like, she looks over her shoulder and she sees like this shadowy figure coming, and she's like, death is coming for me. It's coming to get me. And she's looking and it's coming closer, and like she leans towards it. She's like, I'm ready, death, take me. And then she just vomits all over. Just like up chucks, like vomits all over. And it's just some dude. It's some dude in the alleyway. It's not death. It's some guy and looking for her, and just throws up. And I was like, I'm in. Tell me what happens. I don't care.
Pooping,
whatever happens.
Throwing up.
Yeah, I had a weird
Twizzlers
week.
Twizzlers and Diet Coke. That's how you get
Treated Slam. Slam was like, you know, I pooped six times. I'm like, all right, I'll read the next 20 pages. Whatever. Yakuza Demon Killers. Vomit first two pages. I'm like, I'm in. Let's go. Let's see what happens.
I'm looking at this right now. I don't know if you know what he looks like, but one of the characters like has the black hair with kind of the whitish silver in the front. Yeah. Looks exactly like Adam Jones, the guitarist for Tool.
That's funny.
Like through I had to do a double take thinking that it was him on this page. That's awesome. The artwork is really intense.
Yeah, it's a really cool book, but it has like it also knows that it's called Yakuza Demon Killers, you know. Okay. Like that first sequence when like she's like, you know, she's got the needle and she's got the mark on her arm and death and the shadowy death is coming for her. I'm like, oh my god, this book is terrifying. And then she throws up and I'm like, oh, it's actually kind of in like a joke too in a way. So like, yeah, I had a lot of fun with it and totally unexpected. Like I had a feeling I would like Slam and, you know, Spell on Wheels and Backstagers, those indie books I picked up because I knew I would like them. Yakuza, I was like, oh, I'll read it and see. And I really ended up really liking this book.
Who publishes it?
IDW.
IDW. And who who writes it and illustrates?
Amit Chauhan is the writer. Amit Chauhan and Eli Powell on pencils and K. Michael Russell on colors.
All right. I'm going to have to try it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm definitely reading this.
Yeah. So I'll look for it this week and I'll let you guys know what I think of it next time we get together. Joe, you've got another book you want to bring up real quick. Kill or Be Killed, number 4.
Oh, yeah, I could. Yeah. Very briefly. Yeah. Ed Brubaker, Sean Phillips, Betty Breitweiser. Just it's the best.
It's still good.
You know, it's like modern, super meta, deal with the devil story. Like, this is how you do them. And it's just they're the best. Masterclass. Like, the three of them working together on this book has just been astounding. Mm-hmm. Kill or Be Killed, number 4, Image. Yeah.
Pick it up. So, guys, it's been a long time coming. Peter Panzerfaust, number 24, is finally here.
Wow.
To give you context for that, number 23 came out February 2015. So the series ends at issue 25. So this is... So you see, there's so much frustration building up in me right now about this series because it is so good. It is a World War II Peter Pan story where Peter is an American soldier rescuing French orphans and they all get together and fight Nazis. And Captain Hook is a Nazi. And it's just amazing. It's so fantastic. And when issues stopped coming out, I gave up hope, especially since Peter Pan's Fast wasn't coming out. Pisces had what, two issues? This is all by Curtis Weeb, by the way. Had two issues and haven't seen anything else. Rat Queens is kind of, who knows, but now it's coming back. So the fact that Peter Panzerfaust is back and we're finishing up these last two issues so we can get the entire story is great. The downside is I don't know what's happening in the story anymore. It's been a year and a half. But I will say, you know, I just picked up the issue, started reading. You know, we're fighting Nazis. We're brothers in arms and that kind of thing. Tyler Jenkins' art is still amazing. I love just how sketchy and fluid everything is. The watercolors, just everything just feels gritty. And then that last two-page spread is amazing, leading up to a final showdown between our hero and our villain. Joey, I know I peer pressured you into reading this.
Yeah, I blasted right through it before we started reading, and I was the same way. I was like, I don't even remember this book looking like this. Like, I couldn't even remember like what it looked like, but the characters are so interesting and the story is so clever. Mm-hmm. Like, you almost can't not have a good time, you know? Like, it's just such a fun little concept and a well-executed book from start to finish. And the last spread,
yeah,
is just astounding.
Well, going into the last,
yeah, going into the last, going into the last issue. So yeah.
And you had mentioned to me before we started recording that Rat Queens is coming back.
Yes, March 2017.
Yeah.
Soft reboot is what they call it. Number one, new artist.
Okay.
Owen Genie. I don't know. He did some work for Dark Horse, I think.
Okay. And then we have two more books left. Steve has both of them. One of them we've talked about before, but I'm so glad that you read it.
Yes!
Angel Catbird.
Yes!
Angel Catbird, Volume 1. Margaret Atwood, Johnny Christmas, and Tamara Bonvillon. You guys, this book was absurd. This book was so absurd. I almost feel like I don't even know what to think of it yet. But I did enjoy the hell out of it. I really enjoyed the absurdity of it. Because, first of all, lots of thought bubbles.
Right.
You know, and I really like that because you don't really see those a lot anymore.
Mm-mm.
And I love knowing what characters are thinking and not just what they're saying and not just what their actions are. I like getting inside the heads of characters. I think it's a lot of fun. But the idea of this guy going to work for this company to kind of figure out the missing pieces of an algorithm that will create this splicing, like gene splicing serum that the big boss is looking to get. And like, he's this radish looking guy. He's got like the first scene that you see this dude, his name is Meroid, and Mr. Meroid. And he's got a rat on his shoulder. Then the rat has this little video camera on its head. And I'm thinking to myself, why the hell would this guy have a rat on his shoulder, for one? And two, why does the rat have a camera? What are you filming? What is the purpose of this? So anyway, our hero, he basically figures out the formula while he's at home. He tests it out, and hot dang, it works.
Yes, and it does.
Yeah, so Mercio's like, you know, I need it right now. You need to come. So he basically times everything, and Mercio goes to run over our dude. I keep calling him the dude. I can't remember his name. It was kind of hard for me to pronounce when I first learned it.
Mm-hmm. We'll just call him Angel Catbird.
Yeah.
That's his name.
It was here it is. Philippus.
Oh.
Yes,
is his name. So, but he gets hit. Mercio hits him with a car. The vial breaks all over the street, and unfortunately, his pet cat Ding, short for Schrodinger, bought it in the accident, but Angel Catbird basically transforms because an owl was also involved in the accident. So he transforms into this half, you know, part man, part cat, part owl. And he's this like ripped, majestic gargoyle of the night with feathers and whiskers and these like crazy brown pants that he wears. And it's just amazing. The book goes in such a strange direction. I loved there's all these little kind of like cat facts mm-hmm. and stuff as you're going through, and they're kind of reminding you about caring for your cat and statistics about like feral cats versus home cats and how many of them get hit by cars and like what the lifespans are for each one. Now that Angel Catbird is Angel Catbird, he's able to understand animals. So like birds are talking to him, other cats are talking to him, and they've all got these like really funny personalities. And when you think a bird's like tweeting a song, they're actually asking the other animals for things, for food or for directions or whatever. And it's just super funny. Thalidus kind of learning about his catness and learning about the new urges that come with that mm-hmm. are really funny, that there's another character in the book that he finds himself, you know, wholly attracted to. And it's not in this, like, it's very sexual and a comedic nature, but it never comes off as creepy. Mm-mm. You know, like the concept is so outlandish that it couldn't possibly be offensive. You know, and it's so ridiculous. Like, it goes on from there. You find out that the boss is a rat and there's this war going on and all this stuff is just happening. Like, it's just happening around other humans. They have no idea. It's this weird, like, animal, half human hybrid underworld. It's hilarious.
Mm-hmm. I feel like we're going to be talking about this book again in a couple weeks.
Hell yes, we are.
It's really good. It's really entertaining. And I wish that there was more of it, honestly. Like, it's
coming.
Volume 2 is coming.
When?
February, I think.
All right. Well,
I think it's at least been solicited or advanced like solicited.
Like, I'm reading it, right? And like the book has got these like nice thick pages. Like, Dark Horse has a habit of their hardcover presentation is really, really nice. And I'm looking and I'm like, all of a sudden the story just stops and it's all these different like variant pieces of art that were included in the back of the book and some background stuff and some character test drawings and stuff like that. And I was like, this stuff's really cool, but no, I wanted more story. And oh my God, just one thing. If we ever do character of the year, we're going to need to go back to this book because Count Catula was amazing. He was amazing. He's a vampire cat man, and he's just he comes out of the club. I'm not going to, you know what? You guys are going to read it. I'm not going to ruin it for you. Oh, so good. So good. He's so over the top, and I love it.
Yeah. And you've got one more book for us tonight.
Yeah. This book was a thing.
Oh.
So I didn't have notes for the other books, but I do have notes for this one. Okay. This is, in my best estimation, this is a Joey book. This is a Joey Pricino book. I think you all would enjoy it, but I think Joey in particular would get a real kick out of this one. It's called The Leg, or The Remarkable Reappearance of Santa Anna's Disembodied Limb. That is the full title of the book. It's very long, but it's from Van Jensen and Jose Pimienta, and it is so, I was trying to describe it to Bronwyn earlier today and it was really difficult to do. So basically you find out that this guy by the name of Santa Anna, he's a storied war hero of the Mexican army. He got into a war accident and his leg was blown off. He eventually dies, but his leg survives.
Oh gosh, what?
So his leg survives while inside of this like really elaborate cowboy boot, and it's got this kind of medallion where the tongue of the boot would be, like the lip of the boot all the way up top, and these little straps that kind of look like arms. And so the leg is basically, it survives the death and gets up and decides to go out and to find somewhere where he'll be understood, where he can just kind of retire. And so he goes to live with an old man in the middle of the middle of nowhere, right? He's a cobbler. And he, which is also kind of funny, he's a cobbler. And so the boot goes to live with the old man cobbler. And these guys pull up in a car, and it looks like they're looking for directions. And he hasn't seen anybody in a really long time. He's like, come in, you know, I'll make some coffee and, you know, I'll draw you a map and I'll get you those directions and everything. And they're basically, they figure out in the middle of nowhere, there's nobody to defend him. Whatever money he's made is going to be on hand. So they go to rob him. He gets shot. He dies. The boot, the leg of Santa Ana decides that he's had enough and that he can't stay where he is anymore and he needs to get his revenge. So he decides to make haste to follow the party and their car. And he basically arrives at this town where this escapee, this little girl by the name of Anna, she's been in this kind of boarding school, like this really cruel boarding school where they don't want her to think for herself. They don't, they just want her to worship, and they don't want her to have a voice or have an opinion or any of these things. And she knows her own heritage. She's actually royalty that was taken away from her family and displaced into the school. So she figures that she's going to make her way back to the city, find her family. And in the process, she meets up with the boot. You come to find out that Anna is actually a witch. She practices witchcraft. So the book is really kind of beautiful in its oddness. The dialogue reads very much like a poem. Like there are whole sections and whole passages of this book that are just really kind of make you stop and take a breath. At one point, Anna actually draws like a little face on the medallion. Up until then, it's just blank. And so she gives him a face. She gives him two eyes and a mouth. And from then on, because of her magic, the boot now actually has facial expressions. And so like you could see peril, you can see loneliness, you can see worry, you can see contemplation, and all these things on a boot, you know, like on a dead man's boot with his legs still inside. And it's just such this weird thing. And she draws this face on the lip of the boot. And the next passage just says, smiling for the first time in a century, he resumed his pursuit.
Oh, I'm like, I know, crying right now.
Right. And like, as you move through the book, like you find out that there's magic, there's wizards, there's witches, there's weird culty like religious cults, and there's like this harbinger crow that's kind of leading you through the whole story and telling you this, like all these events in this very sing-song way. There are corrupted giants and poison wells, and it's just really, really phenomenal.
Like a cool book.
Yeah, I was really kind of blown away by it. I found this at NYCC this past year. And I actually got to talk to Jose for a couple minutes, and he did, you know, he drew the little boot and it says, enjoy your journey on the inside of the book. And I'm like, it's got a very, the colors are really cool too. It kind of reminds me of Matt Hollingsworth in that whole sections are kind of done in the one color. So like you'll have lots of, you know, yellow panels, lots of green panels and stuff like that. But then the like things that are important to the story are highlighted in other colors. So you'll get something that's like almost like 90% yellow, but then the gun is, you know, blood red. And the shot going off is red. The fire is like this stark red against this like teal and pale pinks and like deep purples and you know, like sandalwood browns and stuff like that. And it's got a really uplifting message to it by the end. Anna is a tremendous character. As far as this being an all ages thing, it might be a little too mature in terms of the death and kind of like the introspection that comes with the journey. But it's really just beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. And if you can find it, I highly recommend it. I don't even see, I'm trying to look up the publisher, Blue Creek Creative.
Is it on Comixology? Because I will buy it right now.
It probably is. I'll look it up for you. But it's called The Leg or The Remarkable Reappearance of Santa Anna's Disembodied Limb.
It's got a little magical realism to it. I dig it. I like it.
Yeah.
It was so good. Like, going back on it and, like, talking about it now, I'm kind of, like, reaffirming how much I enjoyed it. And it was wild. It goes in so many different directions. There's so many different, like, stories within stories as they're going on this adventure. It's really neat.
Awesome.
Wow.
We have just a couple more things to note before we wrap up. The first one is the announcement of the creative team for the America Chavez solo title.
Yes.
Gabby Rivera and Joe... Help me out, guys.
Quinones.
Okay.
Quinones.
And so they had previously announced that America was going to get her own book, but, you know, we didn't know who would be working on it. And we all kind of hoped that somebody who was, you know, from Latin America would be working on the Latin American character. And it seems that it's true. So,
yes,
as long as nothing changes between now and the book coming out. Gabby Rivera is a name that's new to me. I have not read anything by her or have heard of her before, but I went and looked up her website, and real quick, it says that she is a self-proclaimed nerd burger. Gabby Rivera is a round brown lover boy living in Brooklyn, New York. Her critically acclaimed debut novel Juliet Takes a Breath was listed by Mike as one of the 25 essential books to read for Women's History Month, and it was called the dopest LGBTQIA book ever by Latina. Put simply, by Roxane Gay, it's effing outstanding. Who Roxane Gay is also a new Marvel writer, so that's interesting. Gabby loves craft beer, making white people uncomfortable, and all things Mariah Carey. She's represented by New Leaf Literary and Media Incorporated. So just by that short bio, I'm kind of like, yeah, I'll read. I'm going to be reading this.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the making white people uncomfortable comments.
Yes. Yeah, dude.
If you follow her on Twitter, like, it's, I think her handle is Quirky Rican, I believe. She posted the link to the announcement interview, which was on Refinery. And there's this great, like, quote in there where she talks about getting the call from Will Moss, the editor. She goes like, I work at a LGBTQ nonprofit called GLSEN as a youth programs manager, and I got an email from Marvel when I was at work, and I was like, what? I had everyone just like click-clacking away, and I just left, and I called my mom, and I was like, Mom, I got an email from Marvel. My voice went up 48 octaves. I was super excited. Getting that email from Will was the first time a man had ever written to me about my book, let alone a white guy. And they go on to talk about, you know, they sent her all of the Young Avengers to read the Kieran Gillen run, which again is one of my favorites too. And she talks about how there is a huge kind of like queer and trans community of comics fans online. And she kind of reached out to some of her friends that were in that community and was like, what's the story with America Chavez and all of that, and got a lot of advice from them as well as she started, you know, setting out to write the book. It's a great interview, and it's up on her Twitter. You can find it there.
Excellent. So that book is coming out March 2017. So something definitely to look forward to there.
Mm-hmm. Joe Quinones is very, very good too. He was doing Howard the Duck with Chip Zdarsky.
Mm-hmm.
He did the very, very lovely Black Canary Zatanna
Bloodspell
graphic novel.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, that was him. Done tons of covers for Marvel. Very stylish. Can be cartoony, but still has very nice page layouts that really help sell the story action-wise and emotionally. So it sounds like the two of them could be a really interesting team-up.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that. I definitely think that he's a good fit for the book. And like I said, I'm eager to see what she can do.
Yeah.
So good news, yay, Marvel!
Yeah, love the character.
Yeah. And so,
Joey, go ahead. I'm sorry, go on. Joey, the leg is on Comixology. $10.
I'm gonna buy it right now.
Excellent.
So before we close out the episode, Bob had brought to my attention that it's Thanksgiving week. And we should take a couple of minutes to kind of say what we're thankful for in the comics industry. And I will go first. Mine's real quick. I am thankful for DC Rebirth not being a complete cluster. I have been not reading DC books for a long time, mostly since after a couple of months New 52 started. And I'm glad to be reconnecting with some of the characters that my mom loved, that I grew up on. I'm excited about Superman every other week now, and new Wonder Woman books and things like that. So I'm thankful for DC Rebirth. Bob. Nice.
Lovely. Well, First, I will say something I say every year, and it never gets old to me to say it. I hope it doesn't for you folks. I am very thankful for this. For what we do, and for my colleagues today and those in the past, and for all you people out there who've made this possible and made a very special and loving home for not only us, but yourselves. And so I'm thankful for all you guys. In terms of the comics industry itself, I'm really thankful that even though we complain a lot sometimes about the pace of it and events turn up, the horrible things that people do to each other, mostly on Twitter and things like that. But it's that this industry, even in our 5 years, is changing. It is beginning to represent more closely the world at large, where you're seeing now that the readership is 50-50 men and women. We see many, many more lead female characters in books that are doing well in the marketplace, and that even if they don't in the stores that aren't receptive to that, as we saw with a book this week that didn't get ordered by some stores. We won't go there because we're being thankful. We see trade paperback sales. You go into a Barnes & Noble, you go into a Midtown Comics or Forbidden Planet or what's the store up in Canada, Steve?
Heroes.
Or Champions in Chicago. They're people of all ages, genders, identity, loving comics again. And we are now starting to see with the announcement we just had, it's a lovely segue, the creators are starting to be new and different people bringing great new voices to this industry that I had my doubts 5 years ago. But I think there's a brighter future coming if we can just sort of stay the course. Mm-hmm. So I'm very thankful for that.
Excellent. Steve?
Bob should have gone last.
Ugh,
I know.
I wasn't thinking.
How do I follow that? It's so unfair.
I'm so sorry.
You want me to go, Steve? I'll go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then you're gonna have to follow me too.
I can handle that.
Oh,
I'm so kidding. No, man. If you know what you want to say, go ahead.
I was gonna say pretty much what Bob said as well. You know, when we were going to talk about the Thanksgiving thing, I flash back to when we talked about March. When we talked about March, the John Lewis book, so astounding. And one of the things that he talks about is like the struggle, man, like the fight that we are still on, the march, like we're still marching. And the fact that in the last year, especially, I feel like, and maybe it's just because we've been talking about it more and we've seen greater strides, but like, I feel like we're getting somewhere. I feel like this year, especially, we've seen a lot of great strides in our march and in our movement and to get, you know, diversity and to raise awareness and to start thinking about things. Especially as obviously the world is growing and going in directions that some may find astounding that we are on this path, but at least here, the things that we talk about, we have a space where we can talk about them. We have a space where we have a community that wants to have those conversations, and we have a fan base and a creator base that is interested in reflecting the world. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful for that and thankful for that, especially as someone who, and I talked about this, you know, earlier this year, actually, when we were talking about the Iron Fist stuff, as someone who has had to think about their identity and racially and ethnically and culturally and all of that, like comics gave me an outlet to think about that. And now I'm seeing myself in some of these stories, which is great too. So I'm really grateful for that. And I'm really thankful that we have a space like this where we can do that. Amen.
All right.
Very nice, Joey. Very nice.
Go ahead, Steve. Follow that.
So, you know, we kind of do this every year. And when somebody asks you what you're thankful for, you know, Thanksgiving is a lot of things, not all of it good. But it is a day that you kind of look back, maybe the only other one besides New Year's, where you look back on all the things that have gone on. And, you know, it's been a tough year. It's been a really tough year, but there have been, you know, little pokes of light in the darkness, if you will. And it's also been a lot of there's been a lot of change this year. And one of the things that I'm thankful for in comics is, you know, you guys. You know, I've always had Bob, but bringing Mara into the hosting seat and having Joey, you know, with us full time. I don't know why I'm talking about you guys in the third person. But it's, I really, really am thankful for the direction that we've taken the show and the collective sensitivity that we have, and that we, you know, we talk about the things that matter to us every week. And I think that I walk away from every show, like, even if I'm not 100% satisfied with my contribution on any given night, just because, like, oh, I forgot to say this, or I really should have pressed more for this and whatever, I always walk away from the show feeling like we put out something positive into the community, and that, you know, people are always in flux. We have long-term listeners, we have new listeners, some people drop away and all of these things, but it keeps changing and it keeps moving forward, and I think that that's really important. As much as we've seen some setbacks this year in terms of attitude, in terms of harassment, and in terms of whitewashing and, you know, misappropriating characters and stuff like that, I can think of, like, those things are terrible and they need to be worked on. They need to be addressed. But I remember more positive things happening in comics that far outshine those other things. As important as it is to explore those other things, there have been really, really great things. We've seen tremendous strides in the, like, female contributorship to comics as a whole. I have so many female creators on my potential list for our end of the year awards that it's nuts. they're all coming. Like, they're all there, you know, they're banging the door down. And it's very obvious to me that this was a really strong year for that stuff. And we talk about this every year, and it's nice to feel like we're, you know, finally making some real headway with that.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shame that some of them have been scared away from the craft and things like that. Hopefully they'll come back. And all of that stuff is a shame. And you should be ashamed if you were a contributor to that. But, you know, the love and support that we as comic book fans show the creators, I think just, it means so much more than the hate and the other stuff. And watching people come together and watching people change their Twitter icons and constantly tweeting at these people to make them feel better, whether they be comic creators or comedians, you know, Leslie Jones, for example. Mm-hmm. And just throughout the year where there's been adversity, there's also been people like banding together to say no. Mm-hmm. And I like being a part of a podcast that says no, you know, and
preach.
That's a bumper sticker right there.
No, you know, like, and I'm not trying to put us on a pedestal. I'm not trying to do anything of the sort. This is pride. You know, like I said, it's been a really, really rough year. I've had some really amazing things happen to me personally, but it's been a bad health year for me and other things like that, that this show and getting together with you guys and the brilliant, brilliant books and the brilliant creators that we talk about all year round is what keeps me grounded most weeks. You know, this is always something to look forward to. And, you know, there are whole weeks where we don't even get the chance to talk to one another throughout the week, and then we come together for the show, and we don't miss a beat. You know, And I swear I'm wrapping up, but I'm very thankful for the four of us. I loved, you know, Bobby was on the show for a long time. He did an incredible job for so many years. And I like the synergy that we have. I like the way that the subtle changes are now kind of like the foundation and the concrete of what this podcast is now. And, you know, like I said, we've got new listeners, we've got new people interacting with us all the time. And people have said to others that the show, you know, matters to them. And that matters to me. So,
well put.
Like I said, yeah. You know, I like being part of things that are an advocate for change and positivity. And I think that we do that every week in spades. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud and very thankful for that.
Yeah.
I've got the warm fuzzies now, guys.
Yeah, man. We got great listeners, great contributors, great people here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, seriously, shout out to the Talking Comics team and all the writers and all the reviewers and all the TV watchers and everything that's going on and all the new podcasts and everything. This has been a tremendous year for us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in the year strong.
Keep marching, man. Keep marching.
That's man. You know, and we're going to keep doing it. Yeah. You know, we're going to keep doing it in the face of any of that crap. We're going to, you know, we're going to come through on the other side and just keep trying to put good stuff out there.
Mm. Well said. Well said, guys. Okay, so that's going to be it for this week's Talking Comics. And as always, you can send us comments or questions through our email, podcast@talkingcomicbooks.com, as well as reach out to us on Twitter @TalkingComics. If you've got some things about the comics industry or you and your comics community that you're thankful for, let us know. Like I said, just drop us a quick tweet, couple seconds, because we know we're on the thankful mood now. And there's a lot of good things out there. Just have to look a little harder. It's okay. Don't forget to check out talkingcomicbooks.com for news, reviews, articles about comics, video games, TV shows, pretty much everything. We have a lot of podcasts, The Moon Girl, Devil Dinosaur, Top Shelf Book Club.
Yep.
You guys recorded last Friday, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, they did.
And
yeah.
It is out. And it came out on Monday.
All right. So you guys can listen to that show with Volume 1. Matt and I moved, so we had to delay a week for Hawkman by Jeff Johns, so that's coming out soon, or as soon as Matt finishes reading it. I know. We have the D&D podcast, Talking Games, Talking Movies, Talking Valiant, Talking Trousers with Hugh.
Exactly.
Just a little bit of everything out there. Steve, where can our listeners find you?
You can find me on Twitter and on Instagram. And
yes.
I do it for you, man. I love you. @dead_anchoress. And if I could, just for one second, our next podcast for the Top Shelf Comic Book Club is actually going to be in January.
Okay.
Because there's just entirely too much going on in December. Mm-hmm. But our next book is Death Follows. It is a graphic novel by Cullen Bunn.
That's from Dark Horse, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, I know that one.
So if you want to join us on that, you are more than welcome. We'll be talking about it in January. Plenty of time for you to pick it up and, you know, tell us your thoughts. Death Follows, Cullen Bunn, January.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. Joey, where can listeners find you?
On Twitter and Instagram @JoeyBricino.
And Bob?
Bob Reier @TalkingComicBooks.com.
And I am on Twitter and Instagram as well, @MegaMaramon. So for Bob.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Steve.
Take care, everybody.
And Joey.
Read comics.
I'm Mara Wood. Until next time, to be continued.